This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, we'll get the latest from Battle Creek Enquirer reporter Jennifer Bowman on the controversy surrounding an ethics hearing for a Battle Creek city commissioner. But first, we're going to discuss what's been happening at Western Michigan University, as well as higher education in general, with Western Michigan University President John Dunn. Thank you for being here.
Thank you very much, Gordon. It's nice to be with you and your listeners.
And we're also joined by Kalamazoo Gazette reporter Emily Monticelli.
Thanks for having me.
Emily, first question for President John Dunn.
President Dunn, the Board of Trustees yesterday approved a new sexual assault and harassment policy for Western. Can you tell us why now? What's the significance of the timing now?
Actually, this has been an ongoing project for a little bit over a year. We, like many universities in the nation, have really challenged ourselves as to whether we are getting the actual number of cases reported and that we're dealing with those in an effective and an appropriate manner. And we did a scan, I think this was 13 months ago, and we sort of challenged ourselves about, are we getting the number of reported cases that we should? Are we under-reporting? Are people under-reporting, over-reporting, that kind of thing? And then we also went to a very outstanding, probably the firm in the nation, Pepper Hamilton, and asked them to advise and consult and to look at our existing policy to see if there were any inhibitors there that might be discouraging or dissuading people from reporting. They were extremely helpful. We put together an interim policy. We took that out for review by the community at large, got excellent feedback, and on the basis of that, we're in a great position to put a final policy together, and the board ratified or approved that yesterday. In the interim period, we noticed that the reported cases increased, which we took as a very good sign in that the policy was working, in that we want to make sure that if we have wrongdoing, anything untoward to another human being, that those are reported, brought forward, and that we deal with them effectively. And I think our students and others have responded extremely well. I think that they view this as, this is a caring university. It's a place that wants to make sure that people are treated well. And I think this policy will really help us with that.
Is there a good way of knowing what number of cases should be coming to the university? When we had State Senator Tanya Shoemaker in last month to discuss the summit, which First Lady Sue Snyder held about sexual assault on college campuses, she said about 12% is probably reported. So is there a good way of knowing, what is the number you're getting at where it would indicate that, yes, most, if not all, of those cases are coming to someone at the university in a position to do something about it?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. And, you know, it's one of those challenges of knowing, are you ever at anything at 100%? But in our policy now, it's very clear that we have a duty to report, that all of us do. And that as employees of the university, faculty, administrators, staff, and others, when someone brings to our attention or we observe or see something, we need to make sure that that's reported to our Title IX coordinator. And only in that way, I think, can we begin to be more certain that we're getting a good handle on anything that might be going on the campus that shouldn't be occurring. So, you know, I feel really good about it. I don't know about the percentage. Senator Shoemaker certainly very effective in her legislative role. I did have the opportunity to attend the summit that First Lady Sue Snyder held. Thought it was very good. I was pleased that they also selected the firm that we work with, Pepper Hamilton, as kind of the voice to share with the state as a whole. And I think Pepper Hamilton has affirmed that our policy, you know, at least what we have on paper, it's always about the execution of the policy that's the critical indicator. But we've got the right thing in place now. And so I'm really pleased about that, and I'm very proud of the work that's been done.
One of the other points Senator Shoemaker brought up when we discussed this with her is that the various universities seem to have a lot of different ways of getting their actual numbers. In other words, the reporting and the enforcement seems to be varied across the 15 public universities. Are you satisfied that what Western is doing is following what we might call best practices in terms of getting the most complete data and making people feel as comfortable as possible coming forward?
Yeah, I would actually, without sounding overly arrogant about it, I think we're not only following, I think we're leading. I think we put together the policy that really in many ways is the policy that others should be looking at. emulating in any way that they can what works for them on their campus. But, you know, we've been at this in a very thoughtful and a very proactive way. And so, again, I'm pleased about that. And I think, that others who have looked at and have studied the policy would concur that on paper, we've got it right. The question then is making sure that we execute as we want to do and should do.
Emily?
Can you tell us what is the next step with Colony Farm Orchard?
Yes, Colony Farm Orchard. The next step will be putting together a plan that will be very transparent, available to the region, the larger community, about how we see moving forward. Also establishing a committee, wide distribution in terms of interest of people that have, to make sure that we hear from all of the respective parties. The input, Trustee Hettinger signaled yesterday that he too would be interested in being on that committee. Coming at it a little bit from a balance of the economic developer perspective and background he has, but also someone who's really committed to the environment and sustainability. So it's trying to get all of those voices together in a way that, again, I think models, as we did in the Business Technology Research Park. I mean, the existing park is an excellent example of taking a parcel of land, using it to create jobs and opportunities, internships for students, providing jobs for others, but at the same time being very, very sensitive to the environment. The watershed management there is nationally known as a great model, and we will do no less than that with the movement to the Orchard property. We have a responsibility to do that, and we take that very, very seriously.
When Western developed the Business Technology and Research Park, there is a pretty strict set of guidelines from the city of Kalamazoo. Since Colony Farm Orchard is located in Ashtamo Township, will Western come up with a set of guidelines, or do you know how that will proceed?
I don't think the guidelines we will follow there will be any less rigorous or challenging or helpful as what we saw in the original Business Technology Research Park. To us, it's not adhering to a rigid set of guidelines that are imposed. It's also doing what really is best practices. And again, I'm very proud of the work that went on in the Business Technology Research Park. And I think, again, people who visit there see that, look at the parcel before, and I wasn't here, but I've gone back and looked and studied that. Man, it's quite impressive. And so, you know, again, I think we have a buffer that we agreed to on the back of the engineering. We've always honored that, preserved that. I don't know, and I guess this is part of the committee review and process, if Ashtamo would have anything else that they would want to add to or delete from. Even if they deleted from, I don't think it would dissuade us from what we know to be the very best practices.
State Representative Al Pischalka, who was the chairman of the House Appropriations Committee, really laid into a couple of state universities the other day concerning their tuition increases. Both of them, Eastern Michigan and Oakland University, went above the cap which the state had set. Western Michigan University did not. They held at 3.2% as the state mandated if you wanted to receive some extra money. But I'd like you to maybe take a serious, because what Eastern and Oakland are saying is, look, you know, this, we get more money this way. We were a relatively low tuition university before this, both of them. And this is our response to the state not adequately funding higher education, which is something you've also talked about in the past. So when you went through the process of deciding whether or not you were going to meet this cap, take us through how you ended up landing at, okay, we're going to do 3.2%.
Yeah, I think the discussion probably was very similar to Oakland and Eastern Michigan. And it was very, very difficult for us to resolve that we were going to stay within the cap, the 3.2, primarily because the incentives that have been created and that are being utilized as part of the governor's strategy simply aren't sufficient to really, I guess, capture our attention even this year, last year, and ultimately in years to come. My advice, and I have great respect for Representative Pischalka. He's a Bronco. I think he's thoughtful. We don't agree on everything, but I really respect his analysis and views. If I were to talk with him, and I'll try and do that, I would say, look, talk more about incentives. Basically, Eastern and Oakland played by the rules. The rules were that if you stepped outside of the cap, the additional money on the incentives you would not receive. And they said, okay, We won't receive that. We understand that. But we need to take care of business here. So on the one hand, whether you like it or not, they clearly played by the existing rules. My worry is that there has to be an acknowledgement that we're going to have to do more to provide the support for the universities. I don't think the current incentive model has got all of the right metrics and markers in it. I would use as Western Michigan University our strong commitment to our Sea to Scholars program or foster youth. That doesn't count for anything other than a pat on the back and good job and kudos and wow, you're setting the national standard. But, I mean, help me here. You know, we're doing the right thing, and I think the return on the investment is going to be the right thing for the state of Michigan and for the many, many peoples that that we serve. So, again, I look forward to a little opportunity to talk with Representative Pleshoka, and I have not yet, but he's always open, and he's, you know, he's really been very thoughtful and very clear, and I understand that he could have some significant angst about this. At the same time, I don't think it's right to say Eastern and Oakland, you didn't play by the rules. You did. You suffered the consequences. But I would really like to see us talk more about incentives for doing the right things, look at the metrics, and what it is that we're doing and producing for the state. And I'm very proud of what we produce here. I don't know that that's always recognized in the existing metrics or recognized in the – there's tremendous significance inequities in how much money the state, even under the old model, puts in for each student. I mean, is a student at one place worth or less than somewhere else? I mean, is there an opportunity not to to rethink that? And so, you know, those are tough questions, and we're going to have to wrestle with that.
Emily?
Western has taken quite a bit of heat for demolishing the wings of East Hall and also North Hall. Mm-hmm. Now that the newly renamed Heritage Hall has come together, are you feeling a bit vindicated there?
Well, I don't know if vindicated is the right term, and I understand where you're going with that. You know, we're not big on gloating about anything. What we're big about is saying that we had some property there that was really not being used for any really significant purpose. We're going to come out of this with, as the trustees approved yesterday, Heritage Hall, the home of the Alumni Center on Prospect Hill. And I think it's going to be a very grand place. I've had the opportunity to look at and observe work that's going on. And I think in ultimately that people will say, you know, this is pretty nice. This is a destination. This is a place to go. And not only for the university, but for the community at large. And as you know, I was very concerned when I first came here that we were dealing with a situation that just had not really been addressed. And we took a couple runs at that of other ways to address it, and it just didn't come together. And it seemed to me that under my watch, I had a responsibility to do something. And I respect those who differ and disagree, but at the same time, I'm really quite pleased with where we're coming out with this. And I think many, many people will. I'd like to think most people will, but we'll let others, you know, be the judge of that.
Let me shift back to the state legislature for a moment. State lawmakers proposed an amendment to the state constitution that would require all university board meetings to be held in public. Right now, university boards have an exception that other governing bodies don't have, such as a city commission or a county commission. From where you sit, how would this affect how you do business? Would it make it more difficult in any way if you have to hold more meetings in public?
I've been in various states, in various universities. So I've operated under both from the standpoint of being the most stringent and rigid in terms of what's an open meeting and a closed meeting. So whatever transpires, obviously, as a university, we'll make it work. Now, even under the most stringent of rules, when you get into land acquisition, personnel matters, those have always been appropriate for closed door conversations. A contract would be another one. Okay, that's just the way it is. My view right now, I'm very pleased with our trustees, and if I think there is a responsibility we have to have meetings that have more context, more input as to the thinking and how do we get where we got, and I think our trustees are doing that really, really well. and in particular our current lineup, and I'm really happy about that. I think yesterday was a good example of that. If you sort of counted, I think every trustee at some point weighed in on a question, something they wanted to know more about. All votes obviously have to be in public. They have been. I know of no other time that we've done a sort of a polling of people. And even in states that have very, very strict, I was on a school board in the state of Oregon that's saying, you know, well, maybe we'll make a phone call one-on-one to board members to kind of assess where they are. You know, I think there's some gaming of any of those systems that's really not appropriate or necessary. I would prefer that it not change. And I use as an example, in some states, even in the sort of the contract, the personnel issues, that the press still had the right to be there, but they couldn't report on anything that was said. So even if you had a lunch meeting where you tried to gather people to do that, the press sat there and they couldn't eat. And they, you know, it, to me, it was awkward. It wasn't as helpful as some people might think when they think about transparency. And then if you're a reporter, now you're in a real bind. Did I hear that in there, or did I hear it out here? And how do you draw the line?
Well, the point that this state representative has made in proposing this resolution is that the university boards are given this sort of broad exception to hold informal closed sessions. City councils don't have that, or city commissions. County boards don't have that. Is there a reason that a university board should be treated differently in that respect than any other local government, school board, et cetera?
Well, in our case, I think one could argue that how do trustees become trustees? Are they elected? No. They're appointed by the governor.
But this would apply to all state universities, and the board members at University of Michigan, Michigan State, and Wayne State are elected.
Yeah, I'm addressing it from the Western Michigan University perspective. So, and from that analysis, there would be some difference as it relates to us, at least. There is great value in the president being able to speak freely and openly with one's trustees on what I would call some at times very sensitive issues, and to allow trustees to also ask questions that at times might appear to be very pointed, but also to allow one to hear that, respond to that, and to do so in a way that is without fear that the public at large might misinterpret that. Okay, what's really going on here? I like the opportunities. And again, I said I've been in different states where the rules are different. We can make anything work. This is pretty good. I mean, you really do have full discussions.
Before we wrap up, the last time that our listeners heard from you, we were discussing, unfortunately, the passing of former Western President Elson Floyd. We're speaking on Thursday at yesterday's board meeting. It was decided that the engineering hall at Western Michigan University on the engineering campus will bear the name, ultimately, we're assuming, Elson S. Floyd Hall. Can you tell us why you thought this was a fitting tribute to one of your predecessors?
Yeah, Dr. Floyd, if you go back and track and trace his history here, in the time that he was here from that 1998 to 2003, I think it's 4.5 years, the work that he did in establishing the Business Technology Research Park, and really the sort of the crown and the jewel there was the engineering facility, and being able to make that happen and to be able to finesse that in a way, we really needed to bring engineering together into a facility. So I was very, very pleased and very proud of the board in acknowledging Dr. Floyd, and I will forever feel good about Elson S. Floyd Hall and the significance of that name. Elson and I had the opportunity to get to know one another through some national committees that we were on, and I think people here locally need to really understand and realize that Dr. Floyd did a great job for Western Michigan University, but his national presence was very high, and people respected him deeply. And we miss him, and I'm very, very sorry that, you know, at a much too early age, Dr. Floyd has left the earth. But he will forever be remembered here, and we will find an opportunity in fall to commemorate this more formally, and we're not sure yet exactly when and how to play that out with the family and loved ones, and certainly Carmenta Floyd, Dr. Floyd's spouse.
Western Michigan University President John Dunn, as always, thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Nice to be with you, Emily and Gordon. Thank you very much.
And we want to thank Kalamazoo Gazette reporter Emily Monticelli.
Thank you.
A longer version of the interview with Western Michigan University President John Dunn can be found at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. When the Battle Creek City Commission held a hearing on June 23rd to determine if the city's ethics policy had been violated, the subject of that hearing, Commissioner Jeff Domenico, walked out shortly after the meeting started. When the commission held its next regular meeting 2 weeks later, Domenico was criticizing his fellow commissioners when the meeting was adjourned. Battle Creek Inquirer government accountability reporter Jennifer Bowman has been covering this story. She joins us via Skype. Jennifer Bowman, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So what do his fellow city commissioners say that Jeff Domenico did that violated the city's ethics policy?
Well, it all starts with Facebook posts. He has a Ward 5 city commissioner page, and for a while he's been pretty critical of the police administration and the department itself, and has posted, you know, links to stories. The most recent, which kind of started this ethics hearing, was a letter to the editor that was actually posted in the Inquirer, and it had to do with a tow truck contract that the department had and a constituent who had a bad experience with them. And he had posted that link and said, oh, you know, under any circumstances, please do not contact the police department because they want to control how that response will be. And so what that triggered was three commissioners who thought he may have violated the ethics code. And they presented him with an envelope and with the citations of the ordinance where they said he violated. And so they alleged that he had may have represented his opinion to be that of the entire city commission and had maybe not encouraged or maintained a positive workplace environment because of his intimidation of public employees in his Facebook posts.
This ethics policy is relatively new. How did it come into being?
It is. So they've had an ethics code for a little over a decade now, but until recently they didn't have any kind of policy on how to handle any perceived violation. And so for about the past year and a half, a subcommittee of the commission had looked into this, and they had gone through several drafts of how to handle this. Just the beginning of this year, they finally adopted it, where they had levels of sanctions, what exactly the punishment would be. And this ethics hearing last month was the first time that they were able to use that policy, which is pretty quickly after they've put that policy in place.
Now, Domenico left the June 23rd meeting. He claimed that the city commission had violated the Open Meetings Act. What's the basis for that claim?
So that was a pretty lively meeting in the first couple of minutes. He immediately called a point of order saying that the meeting was unconstitutional, that it violated the Open Meetings Act, that it violated the ethics code itself. He alleged that having an attorney present, which the city did not use its city attorney, they had someone else, an outside counsel. They said that he was supposed to handle just parliamentary procedure, see how the meeting's going. That's not what Domenico believed what was going on. He believed that Jim Dyer actually represented the city commission for legal counsel. And so that was his point of order. But he's also said that the mere decision to have the ethics hearing, which needed three commissioners to sign that notice, he said broke the Open Meetings Act. He said that they deliberated outside of a public setting. He took issue with being given his notice after a meeting, not during the meeting. So he says, and he says he hasn't been given due process.
Does Domenico dispute that he violated the ethics policy? Is this, in other words, strictly about process and the way it was carried out?
Well, so I sat down with him a couple days before the ethics hearing, and I asked him, I said, I don't want to put any words in your mouth, so do you believe you broke the ethics code or do you not? And he said, yeah, I think I did break the ethics code, but if I didn't break the ethics code, I would have broken the ethics code, which he says, yeah, I broke the ethics code. He said he knew what he was doing. He said that his concerns and his criticism of the police department has fallen on deaf ears. He says that both previous and current administration have ignored his request to look into issues. He says that part of the ethics code itself is you have to stand up for the people and ensure that the people are getting the right services for city government. And so he says, I'm damned if I do, I'm damned if I don't. But that actually was a pretty big part of the ethics hearing and of the city commission meeting this week, that, hey, you told the Inquirer that you broke the ethics code. Is that true? And he says, yes. And some of the city commissioners argue, then whatever you're saying, you know, it doesn't matter because you're admitting that. Now, he is at the city commission meeting this week. He said, I know what the violations are and I understand them, but he wanted to know more about what the ethics hearing was about his conduct that led up to those violations. He seems to have questions about that. And of course, city commissioners replied, if you had stuck around for the ethics hearing rather than walking out just minutes after, you may have found out.
What is the punishment for violating the ethics code?
So there's several levels depending on what ethics code you violated. And his was a level one sanction, which means the mayor and the vice mayor can sit down in a private setting and give him a verbal reprimand. Now, he's already gotten two verbal reprimands. However, those were before the ordinance was ever put in place. Because this has happened the first time after the ordinance has been passed, it's technically his first violation. Now, the city commission also had the option to determine whether a harsher punishment was needed. And it's pretty limited as far as what you can do for that. I mean, you can remove him from his committee assignments. You can do a formal censure. Depending on what the law is and if it's appropriate, the governor can remove him from office. However, that seems pretty far-fetched. But they decided not to go with that. They unanimously decided they're going to give him a verbal reprimand, the mayor, Deb Owens, and Vice Mayor Lynn Ward Gray. And they notified him of when they would do that. He was supposed to meet with them at 5:30 p.m. on Tuesday before the city commission meeting, and I was told he did not show up.
So he's had previous verbal reprimands. Is there any feeling amongst commissioners that these really aren't doing much if he's continuing to post things on Facebook and do things which he himself acknowledges probably violate the ethics policy?
So I think the frustration among his fellow commissioners was really apparent on Tuesday. I mean, they adjourned the meeting as he was continuing to argue, just abruptly adjourned. I think a lot of the comments during that time before they ended the meeting was, you know, we're just going in circles. We're not going anywhere. You even saw some frustration from city manager Rebecca Fleury, who said, hey, I have not ignored your requests. I've told you what we've done, what previous administration has done, and that the issue is resolved. Now, you're not happy with that resolution, but if the rest of the city commission felt like they also weren't happy with that resolution, they would direct me to look further into it, and they haven't. So there's a lot of frustration among administrators and his colleagues on how it's being handled. I don't see any pausing or slowing down by Domenico. I mean, he's been a vocal critic of the police department. I mean, he contacted the state attorney general because he had concerns that the department was corrupt. And that's been going on since late 2012. And so it's really hard to say, you know, whether there will be any slowing down. I've never seen any indication of that from him. I don't know what his colleagues can do now that he didn't show up for a verbal reprimand. The way I read the ordinance, I'm not the city attorney. I don't know if there's a next step in place unless he were to violate the code again, and then they can go for a harsher sanction.
It doesn't sound like this is resolved. What might Jeff Domenico do next?
Domenico hasn't really said whether or not he's going to run again. We've got an election in November, and the commission, like I said, those are pretty limited sanctions they can do for any violation of the ethics code, for any frustration they have about, you know, his concerns and how he's publicly criticized the department. And so he's an elected official, and it really stands on the voters.
Jennifer Bowman, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Jennifer Bowman is government accountability reporter for the Battle Creek Inquirer. She joined us via Skype. You can find links to her stories on the ethics hearing involving Battle Creek City Commissioner Jeff Domenico at the Battle Creek Inquirer's website, as well as at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.